This is the second hour in the sequence, Theology of Peacemaking. The separate hours are quite dependent of one another. And I'll be talking mostly descriptively, historically, about the development of lines of thought, and specifically about the 19th century, and beginning with Tolstoy, the theme, the phrase, the law of Christ, is the appropriate way to render his way of theologizing about peacemaking. We're interested in the 19th century, not for its own sake, but as background, as a part of the growth of a modern vision. But if we use the imagery of growth, that means that it didn't start where it ended. And we need a certain mental exercise to begin at the beginning and not ask of it that it be right away at the ending. That is a cross-cultural understanding. Just as if you were today trying to understand a Muslim or a Brazilian Indian in the Amazon, you would expect to try to learn the cultural framework in which they live in order to know what it means that they say what they say. So also the distance between here and the phenomena I'll be talking about needs to be looked at as a challenge to cross-cultural understanding. Tolstoy was Russian, and that means already a cultural distance from here. He came out of and spoke to the Eastern Orthodox Catholic cultural and moral tradition, which is very far from most of us, even though he himself was involved in that part of Russian culture which was leaning toward the West, in which they learned Western European languages, and traveled in Western Europe, and borrowed some of their patterns of art and literature from the West. He was still very deeply rooted in a world that's very different from our own. And not only is there distance in that kind, but there's distance in time in that he represents an earlier phase of the developing of something which was to be left behind. And it's always a special challenge to understand the validity of something which wasn't the last word, but was perhaps necessary as an earlier word. Leo Tolstoy became famous, first of all, on other grounds. In fact, there are many people who don't even know about him, that he wrote enormous biblical commentaries and theological compendia. He was a storyteller, first of all, and it's that which made him famous. He told short stories, taking off from the style of the folk tale, the legend, and he was one of the creators of the literary form of the epic novel. And for that he was famous not only in his own country, but in Western Europe and North America. What he represents with regard to the theology of peacemaking is a position which is actually older than Tolstoy's discovery of it, so that after locating it with him, we'll move back and try to interpret it in a wider framework. But before that, we'll look at the 19th century phenomenon itself. It would be more interesting to quote a lot from Tolstoy, because he was a good writer. He argued effectively. His rhetoric is impressive. Unfortunately, the library here doesn't have the works that I would most need to quote from. There is one book in the catalog that's not on the shelf. That might mean somebody's studying it. It might also mean somebody liberated it, but it isn't the one I'd read from anyway. The text in which he most clearly states his coming to a peace position is a confession. He calls it that, and that's important itself. Confession is a special literary form. Confession is also a special spiritual form. It's a different way to talk about spiritual realities than numerous of the other ways we talk about spiritual realities. The one who confesses tells a story which is real for that person because it happened to him or her. And it's told in the first person. It's told with a dimension of vulnerability. It usually involves exposing something of one's faults, of a past that one now disavows. So it's a much more committed form of communication than many. Not only do I, if I confess, commit myself, lay myself open, expose my weaknesses and my comings and goings before you, the confession also tends to lay a claim on the listener. If this happened to me, it can't be indifferent to you. Well, maybe it can be, but the literary form of the confession expects to evoke understanding, even sympathy, empathy, maybe even assent, because I tell you my story, the story of my conversion, if I tell a conversion story, with the thought that it might be a model for your conversion. Not just for you to shoot it down or laugh at it, but that it might also speak to you and be meaningful for you. So Tolstoy is a convert to his peace theology. It did not develop organically out of where he came from, either his Western upper middle class literary education, nor his old petty nobility background within Russian Orthodox culture. It was something new. And the meaning of a conversion is a special kind of access to the position one comes to. If you gradually grow into who you are, if you just progressively become a little more of what you were already in the process of becoming, it's not easy to distinguish between yourself and your environment, your family, your culture, your system, which made you who you are. It's not easy to have any leverage then to critique your system, because you are so much the product of it. The convert is, however, someone who has been changed from what his system made him or her by forces from beyond the system, and therefore has by definition leverage to critique the system, has a place to stand from outside the system. So the phenomenon of the convert, the posture of the convert, is a distinct way of coming at anything, but now we're interested in the fact that it's a distinct way of coming at the problem of war and peace. The word God can have two kinds of meanings. And this is not something that Tolstoy or I invented. It's there in the history of culture and language. The Dutch historian of religion, Arend van Leeuwen, distinguishes between ontocracy, in which God is identified with the way things are, ontos is just the Latin root for the way things are, for being, and theocracy, God ruling or history, in which the nature of God is such that he makes things change. He intervenes, he breaks in, he commands. All of those not a God that is the same as the system, but a God who from outside the system tells the system which way to go. Walter Brueggemann, the currently rather popular interpreter of the Old Testament, dean and Old Testament teacher at Eden Seminary in St. Louis, distinguishes between the royal image of God in the Old Testament, who is identified with nationhood and with the power structure of ancient Israel, and the prophetic, who is precisely critical of that. Well, there's something of that going on when Tolstoy is converted from being an ordinary, established, Orthodox Christian to something else. Now, there is no stronger case of God being allied with the system than Tsarist Russian Orthodoxy, in which the church and the empire were not distinguishable. The empire was a holy empire, heir in their minds to the Holy Roman Empire, at first at Christian Rome and then at Christian Byzantium and then at Moscow. there was no distinction between the royal house and the Holy Synod that governed the church. It was all one divine establishment. How then do you get leverage for change? What can make conversion possible? One of the ways that Tolstoy became a different kind of person was, of course, his literary and psychological genius. He could write well. He could convince people. He could tell stories that would draw people into what he was talking about. Later, he also became a self-educated theologian and philosopher and wrote enormous volumes. But it wasn't that that convinced anybody. But how he got there did. But as a literary thinker and as a debater, the path of explanation whereby he now clarifies to us in his confession what happened in his conversion, as distinct from the biography of it, that is a time of despair, a time of happiness, and a time of being suicidal, and finally he decided this, and finally he decided that. He can tell his confession autobiographically in that way, but the thought behind his confession is a very specific centering process. And in the middle of his confession, again in his later book, The Kingdom of God, there is the phrase, the key to the gospel. Well, the key is something that opens up all the rest. He came to the conviction that there is one key, the center of a series of ever-narrowing concentric circles, not the religion of the church, but the scriptures. Not the whole Bible, but the Gospels. And at each of these stages, he can argue why it is that that centering is necessary. Not the Gospels in their entirety as a narrative of many kinds of things, including storytelling, including comings and goings of Jesus and his disciples, including the Passion, but the teachings of Jesus. And not just the general teachings of Jesus about the nature of God and how to see the universe and how to pray, but the moral teachings of Jesus. And not just all the moral teachings of Jesus, but the Sermon on the Mount. And not just the Sermon on the Mount, but the six antitheses in chapter 5 of Matthew's Gospel, where Jesus says six times, "You have heard, but I say." And not just those antitheses in general, but the last one, in which he says, "You have always known that you're supposed to love your neighbor, but you thought you could hate your enemy. I say, no, love your enemy. Go the second mile. Don't resist the evil one." Those few sentences, that sentence, "Don't resist the evil one." That's the newness in the moral teaching of Jesus. And everything else unfolds from there. All of theology is reoriented from that one newness in the ethical good news of Jesus. Now that happens to coincide with the behavior of Jesus, happens to coincide with the lifestyle of the early church, happens to coincide with the lifestyle of a Russian peasant. So Tolstoy could come back from that powerful centering to everything, to storytelling, and all the rest of his journalism and his social culture criticism. But the key that turned him around was that the solution to the problem of evil, the fundamental cosmic problem under God in the world, is not to return it, to suffer it. And the reason we know that, to start with, is that Jesus said it. Then you can figure it out. It makes sense after all. You can see other reasons to believe it as well. But the fundamental problem of the world is that we have been continuing a vicious circle of evil, passing on to others the evil that is done to us as prevention or as compensation or as punishment or vengeance. However, we always keep the cycle of evil going, and the only solution ever will be to stop the cycle of evil by our decision not to pass it on. That's the fundamental cosmic change. Jesus, first of all, taught it. Then, of course, Jesus did it. Then the early Christians did it. And all good and loving people everywhere have done it. But certainly the church that supports the Russian Kaiser, Tsar, doesn't do it. The established churches don't do it. National ideology doesn't do it, whether Christian or of this kind or Christian of that kind. Therefore, there is a sweeping critique of what Christianity has become. The established Christianity of the Russian Empire, but he'd say the same thing about the established Christianities of the West. What is supposed to be in this library is not his confession. There are some of his stories. But there is a book of his writings on nonviolence, which are occasional writings. And if the book ever comes back, or if you see it on some other shelf somewhere, it's fascinating because it shows the enormous flexibility with which he carried on for the next 30 years. A running debate with everybody in the West. He read all the Western newspapers, he sent articles to the Western newspapers, he wrote letters to the editors, he kept in touch with North American and French and British and German public life, and he was always writing somebody letters and commentaries on what was going on from this perspective. So he was almost a journalist. He was a contemporary culture critic, in addition to continuing to write novels and stories. And his increasingly complex philosophical debates about his understanding of the rejection of violence. Ultimately, he moved away from the centrality of Jesus to a broader notion that if it's true for the Christians, it ought to be true for everybody, and to a downplaying of the distinctiveness of Christianity. But when he had started, it was just that simple. The center of the gospel is that Jesus creates a new way to behave. He breaks the chain of evil for evil, and empowers his disciples to live that new reality. And if we all live that new reality, we got a new world. So the breakthrough was Jesus, specifically the Jesus of the Sermon on the Mount. This argumentative approach of Tolstoy's fails to convince us if we want to argue. If you let yourself be carried along by the argumentative flow of his exposition, it's impressive. But if you sit back and try to do debate between the various classic theological traditions, it isn't overwhelming, especially for two reasons. He is very literal about taking the words of Jesus straight. That is, he doesn't recognize any problems in the interpretation of ancient texts, that words may have had different meanings. And all of the kinds of considerations of how to deal with ancient texts that make it much more complicated in our time than in his, to take texts simply. And secondly, his style is legal. That is, he's asking, what is the rule? We ought to behave according to the rules. Well, then what are the rules? Does the rule say that or this? It says this, therefore this is what we have to do. And that legal level of thinking about moral choice is also something that, from the perspective of our culture, there are reasons to be dissatisfied with. But this is the point at which we have to check ourselves and go through the exercise of being dialogically fair with another culture. We have to ask, how were people able to think about these matters in the 1830s, 40s, 50s, and not bring to bear 20th century style of analysis or cultural perspectives that nobody else had in that situation either. Now, to reinforce the thinkability of that kind of simple position, I'll change continents and cultures and refer to things that were going on in 19th century America that most of us don't pay much attention to in 20th century America. It's one of the peculiarities of the American experience that most of it went on when we weren't here yet. So that especially the peoples who came to be culturally integrated in America in only this century don't have a sense of what went on in the American 19th century as being their history as far as Christian thought is concerned. How many people here are here whose ancestors were all in North America in 1860? Most of you not, see? you've made Abraham Lincoln your own somehow. Maybe even you've made Thomas Jefferson your own. But you probably haven't thought much about William Lloyd Garrison or about Alexander Campbell or Charles Grandison Finney. That is, the religious history of America lies there in its 19th century, and it isn't our religious history, because some of you brought Norwegian religious history and some of you brought Germanic religious history, but the old country is where we got our religious history, and the new country is where we got our political history. So we have let the public schools introduce us into Jefferson and Lincoln, but not to some of the things that were going on in this land religiously in the 19th century. And two of them are right on our subject. There was a very impressive development in the early 19th century along the eastern seaboard of a new social form, the society, the voluntary association. It was possible before, but there was something about the level of urbanization and literacy that just made it ripe for people who had some cause to create a voluntary association to be its bearer. There had been some of that kind of thing in Europe in the age of Pietism, when people founded Bible societies and mission societies. But here it was a much more important part of the life of society that people would come together voluntarily and create a brand new organization around some cause. It might be Sunday schools, it might be overseas missions, but sometimes it was peace. And the peace societies that were founded in the major eastern seaboard cities around 1810 to 1830 were a major part of what was going on in the cultural scene, especially in Boston and New York, but also Philadelphia. These people were not silly people. They were not peasants. They were the cultural and intellectual elite of the time. Their movements were non-sectarian, and of course that was especially a new concept in North America, where all of the religious bodies were equal, and a new cause wasn't the property of any one church, so they intentionally made it non-sectarian. These people, the Peace Society people, there was a man named David Dodge in New York, and several others who created this kind of agency already before the War of 1812, but especially after the War of 1812, used the same kind of argument that we find in Tolstoy. That is, a coincidence on the one hand of humanistic common sense. It's just stupid to be fighting wars against people. It's counterproductive. Look at what Europe just did again, laying itself waste in the Napoleonic Wars. And a simple lay Christian understanding of the words of the Bible, especially the words of Jesus, without much dogmatic background, as a basis for cultural criticism. This combination of humanism and lay biblicism is just the same in these people in the American 19th century as it is in Tolstoy, completely independently. They didn't know of each other's existence. There was also more of that secular pacifism at the time. Victor Hugo was a kind of pacifist. The early Tolstoy, before his conversion, was already a critic of war, of course. And the artistic elite, people like Goya in the age of the Napoleonic Wars, were radically anti-military. The chief of these peace society people was William Lloyd Garrison, 1804 to 79, so he comes a little later than the beginnings of these societies. And he took the same simple position, same kind of position, on three questions: slavery, war, and women. This was the first American feminist movement. It was the American abolition movement, and it was, to use Garrison's term, the non-resistant movement. On all three grounds, there was a meshing of secular common sense, humanism of the best kind, that is, affirmation of human reasonability and dignity, and the simple words of the Bible, so that slavery is simply wrong and war is simply wrong. They didn't have special organizations to make feminism a third parallel cause, but there were women involved in these movements more than anything else that was going on at the time. As the abolition movement grew stronger, there came to be a tension between the anti-slavery movement and the anti-war movement, Garrison was the founder of both. He edited the papers of both and printed them at the same press, and for a while sent them over the same mailing list. But increasingly, the two movements drew apart because some of the abolitionists were willing to have a civil war in order to put an end to slavery. He wasn't. Gradually, they did break apart. But the thing we need to learn as just a monument in American history is that for some 15 or 20 years, the same simplicity which created the abolition movement, which was finally a successful political cause, although at the cost of a tragic war, was also producing a pacifist movement with the same kind of reasoning, same style of logic, simple appeal to the obvious words of Jesus that Tolstoy was using. The second current in American religious life was mostly on this side of the Alleghenies, that is the frontier space of the time, where instead of just finding a modus vivendi among the existing already established churches, there was room for evangelism, for planting new churches, and the more aggressive churches would have the most success in creating a constituency in the frontier territory. And here they developed a church renewal experience whose first concern was not with the ethics we've been talking about, but with the shape of the church, called by some people the Restoration Movement. That was the favorite internal self-designation. Wanting to simplify the Christian life by returning to the sources. We have the Presbyterians who bring their tradition from Scotland, and we have the Lutherans who bring their tradition from Germany, and we have the Anglicans who bring theirs from England, and we're just all confused about all these kinds of Christianity. Why don't we forget it all and go back to the Bible? That was convincing in the 19th century. The people who did it the most convincingly were the disciples, Alexander Campbell being their biggest name. There were other groups that were parallel with the same notion. Their intention was not to form a new denomination, but somehow to transcend denominationalism by not having sectarian identity at all. So one group of Presbyterians in western Pennsylvania became so convinced of the idea that there shouldn't be denominational identity that the last action their synod took was to go out of business. We hereby move and pass, move and second and pass the resolution that we no longer exist. So as soon as that was voted, they no longer existed. And then there were a network of independent congregations, each just believing the Bible. Well, that, as a solution to the problem of the dividedness of Christians, it's a little too simple. It has created several denominations instead of fewer. It is nonetheless a different angle on the structure question, but what's important for our purpose is that this way, again, Alexander Campbell and his colleagues in the other movements, the Churches of Christ and the Churches of God, were pacifists, because they again took Jesus simply, and now in their generation they saw the Civil War and saw that it was dividing their churches, and that there were going to be people of their churches on both sides, and that this wasn't a way to resolve the slavery question. Some of them held to their rejection of violence all through the war. Some of them compromised somewhat or didn't make it a matter of church discipline. The point remains that it was there, again, in 19th century Biblicism, which was not, like 20th century Biblicism, obscurantist. It isn't an anti-intellectual movement. It's the movement of an intellectual elite, both the founders of the societies in the Eastern Seaboard and the Restorationists in the Midwest. In fact, it was these Restorationists in the Midwest who covered the Midwest with a network of colleges. They were the founders of frontier colleges. They were the editors and the educators of the time. So that 19th century experience runs parallel to Tolstoy in a completely different world, in the coincidence of human common sense about how stupid and destructive war is. Remember, the wars that they were thinking of were pretty far back and pretty small until the American Civil War, with the simple words of Jesus, the way any lay person would read them if they just read them straight, and forget about the dogma, and forget about the theories, and the intervening centuries that have given us creeds which say other things. not the Bible of divinity schools and dogmatic traditions, but the Bible of literate lay people. So that's the focus. And these people are regularly non-sectarian, abolitionist with regard to slavery, pacifist is our present subject, feminist, often pro-Indian. And this current went on toward the end of the century, represented by Jonathan Blanchard, the founder of Wheaton College, which is now a center of American militarism, and by D.L. Moody. Blanchard and Moody were both pacifists. The schools that survive them are both non-pacifists. Jesus is somebody who tells us how to live, that simply. And anything that gets in the way of that simplicity is the defense of the special interest of the established church down through the centuries. Without having the Russian Orthodox to tackle, they come up with similar arguments. Now to step back several centuries with the theme of the law of Christ, as Christ as the one who informs us of the shape of God's will. The 16th century has created for most of us a kind of culture filter that does earlier concepts of law get through without changing them. The Torah, the law in Jewish thought, is revelation of God's whole making, peace making, saving purposes, its enablement, its freedom, that is, a call to live in a way that resonates with the nature of the universe and God's purposes. Torah is grace. Torah is the gift of covenant in which to live in line with God's will, in Jewish thought. The law in the Middle Ages is pedagogy for crude people just moving from barbarianism into civilization. The law is guidance and, again, enablement. The law is culture. It's the benefits of knowledge. All of this was knocked aside in the 16th century because of other agenda. The agenda of personal salvation, which can't be by the law. The agenda of anti-Jewish bias. And perhaps, some people might think, the agenda of wanting to avoid some of the hard simplicity of the words of Jesus about such things as giving away your goods and loving the enemy. In any case, since the 16th century, law has become a bad word for Protestants. Now, whether the 16th century was all right, or all wrong, or partly right, at least we're not doing an honest job of cultural anthropology if we read the 14th century or the 15th century through 16th century glasses. So that's why I'm inviting you again to a work of cultural flexibility to understand the pacifism of the Middle Ages, which was much like that of Tolstoy. Geoffrey Nuttall is a contemporary, I'm not sure he's still living, but he was not too long ago, British Congregationalist church historian who has written a good little book, Christian Pacifism in History, which he characterizes the pacifism of different epochs in an effort to distinguish between the different tones of voice and different styles of reasoning. He talks about the pacifism of the early Christians as the avoidance of idolatry, because the Roman power for which they didn't want to fight was an idolatrous power. And he talks about the pacifists of the Middle Ages as obeying the law of Christ. So that comes back to our theme. From Francis of Assisi and Peter Waldo at the beginning of this period to the Czech Brethren at the end, the way of thinking about the peacemaking God that is the most convincing is the one that Tolstoy was to come to four centuries later. Waldo and Francis were almost contemporaries. Waldo was just a few years ahead. They had a very similar vision. They both believed in preaching the gospel in the language of the people, in the vernacular, which was a new idea. They believed in walking around, itinerating. They believed in living on the level of the people to whom they preached, mendicancy. They both believed that what they were doing was in line with Catholic Christianity. They both went to the Pope and got authorization. The difference was that when Peter Waldo got back to Lyon, the local bishop didn't recognize that the Pope had authorized that, and told him he should stop, and he refused to stop, so his movement became what was called a heretical movement, whereas the followers of Francis of Assisi never had that kind of opposition and therefore could continue with the blessing of their local bishops. But the position they took was the same, and it was the same. The life of Jesus is the model for our life. To live according to the gospel meant to itinerate and live from the gifts of the people you preach to. That was the phrase, live according to the gospel. And the reason for doing it is that Jesus says do it. You don't need a theory of society. You don't need a theory of the orders of creation or the state or the place of evil in the world. You just have this model. And the God giving us his form, the law of God, is a gift of grace. It isn't the bad news of the law gospel understanding of the 16th century. It's the good news that we know how God wants to help us please him. And we can enter into collaboration with God through the teachings of Jesus, the example of Jesus, the guidance of the Spirit, in order to be within the world what God wants us to be. The next place that surfaced was the Czech Reformation. We've all been taught that the Reformation started in the 16th century. It really started in the 15th in Czechoslovakia, in the teachings of Jan Hus, or Hus. He was a renewal preacher in the capital city of Prague, who was martyred by the Council of Constance. That is, he was promised that if he came to explain himself to them, he could go home safe, and then they broke the promise and executed him. Out of that arose a national uprising in which there was a violent wing and a moderate national wing and a nonviolent wing. The other two didn't survive. The nonviolent wing survived and created the Czech Brethren, Unity of Brethren, which formulated its covenant structure in 1467, so that's really the oldest Protestant church in history, and represent the background of out of which came also the Moravian denomination. All along this way, there is the same understanding of the Sermon on the Mount giving us a valid lifestyle. One of the ways they argued it the most simply were some of the scholars within the Czech Reformation. There are six commands in Matthew 5. Who gave us those six commands? Jesus. Does Jesus have the right to give us commands? If he's the Son of God, he probably does. Well, then we have the Ten Commandments and the Six Commandments. And they have the same status. So that they could take in the language of scholastic debate, even the claim that the teachings of Jesus are binding for us, and that loving the enemies is one of those that's to be taken just as simply as not coveting or not committing adultery. There's a global cultural criticism involved here, and the Czech Brethren founder, Peter of Chelčic, is the strongest. He sees Constantine as at the basis of everything. Our discussion yesterday evening ended with the recognition that when Christianity became an empire religion, it had to change its character. That's what these people saw looking back on the fact that Christianity had become an established religion. He used the picture of the net, which, as you know from the New Testament itself, is an image of the church. The net holds together the fish out of the wider reaches of the lake. But the mistake that was made in the 4th century was that they got a whale in the net. And the whale broke the net, so that the net can no longer distinguish what's in the church from what isn't. And the broken net is the loss of the specificity of the Christian church in the 4th century. And now you can't tell the difference between in and out. You have the same moderate, mixed, diluted morality for everybody. And the nature of the church as the body of believers has been lost. Chelčický was also a critic of the class structure, of the feudal oath, and of course about violence. After Leo Tolstoy had his thing going for 10 or 15 years, he discovered the writings of Chelčický. and republished some things, in fact, showing that what he had happened upon in his conversion was actually the critical undercurrent of Western Christian renewal thought since the age of Waldo. Now, to summarize placing this, in order to take the rest of our time for free discussion, to talk about peace based in the law of Christ, who simply tells us, love your enemies, is far narrower than the whole New Testament. Doesn't talk much about the death of Christ, doesn't talk about the resurrection, doesn't talk much about the church and his body, doesn't talk much about hope, doesn't talk about the kind of thing I talked about yesterday evening. It's narrower than the 20th century agenda. In our age, we do care about the inner psychic dynamics of love and hatred and what it takes to be a loving person. We also talk about the social dynamics of what makes things happen. We have structural awareness. We don't just ask what's forbidden, what's commanded. We have awareness of our own involvement in the wider social mix, so that we can't do, as Tolstoy did, think that if we just stayed home and farm, we aren't responsible for the Russian Empire. And yet, there is something about this starting point of modern peace theology, whether it be the modern West in Tolstoy and Alexander Campbell, or early modernity in the late medieval critics, that speaks to an abiding need. It gives us a leverage from beyond. It tells us that there is some base acceptable to ordinary people, to literate laity. It's not the reserved property of the divinity schools and the theologians and the priests, where ordinary people can know what it is that their Lord Jesus asks of them that makes them different and provides leverage from outside the system in order to tell us which way to go. And in that sense, I would argue that a certain lay legal mentality has, not only in the past, but can also today be a necessary part of the renewal of Christian moral seriousness, even though in our academic work or in traditional work with the way you think about ethics, it's too simple. It is a simplicity with which it's possible to begin. And that is a kind of beginning. We'll talk the next time about going on from Tolstoy in modern Western development. But that discovering, with all of the freshness of a convert, that they'd always told me that war is a Christian thing to do, and the church has been blessing war, and war has been blessing the church, discovering that Jesus says it shouldn't be that way, was the beginning of the reversal that made Tolstoy a completely different kind of teacher, and made him one of the sources of the change that has come over our Western mentality since then. Up to you to go from there. Sorry, we don't have common readings, but I think some of you know something of the man's weight through his fiction, and that placing him in the wider 19th century context may give us some basis, at least, to keep on talking about what he means.
How much like liberation theology is this, today's liberation theology?
No, this is clearly different at its level from today's liberation theology. It says you shouldn't fight back. It doesn't quite mean that you shouldn't fight back at all. But at least the first point is the restraining and setting aside of the need to fight back, the urge to fight back. Now, Tolstoy was still a kind of political activist. He made trouble for the government. He collected funds for dissenters and helped them emigrate. And he was politically active. But his theory was one of not acting. Because if you respond to evil with evil, you keep the cycle going. If you just stop and absorb it and suffer, that'll stop the cycle. So the theory actually called for not being actively involved in the ongoing struggle. And he was seen that way already by the Marxists of his time, before the Russian Revolution, the socialist movements, as undercutting, as cutting the nerve of their liberation agenda. He agreed with them and criticized him everything that was going on in the Tsarist culture, but he didn't agree with them that a righteous revolution was what they needed to do.
John, I'm always bothered by that. Resist not evil. You seem to imply sometimes when you talk that it meant resist it not with violence, and yet other times that it just meant to resist not evil. But if you take the Beatitudes, blessed are you who hunger and thirst to see justice done, that means some resistance. I mean, you can't just hunger and thirst to see something happen and not do anything about it. Jesus didn't say resist not evil with violence. He just said resist not evil, but it seems like his whole life was against principalities and powers. How are we to take that?
There's a difference between asking what Jesus meant or how we should take Jesus and asking how Tolstoy took Jesus. And for now, I'm reporting that it was the basis of his conversion experience for Tolstoy to have the sense that the otherness of the will of God and the authority that God has to give us a knowledge of his will is such that if he tells us not to resist, we shouldn't resist, and that'll be right, and it's not our business to figure out the consequences. So the basic spiritual experience for Tolstoy in his conversion was to take that in the most passive sense. And as I just said to the other question, when he spelled that out, he actually meant that. You just take it, just suffer. That's different from whether that's fully what Jesus meant. It's even different from whether that's what Tolstoy actually did, because he did resist on other levels, literally, economically, and by starting movements. Now, if we step back from that to ask what I think Jesus meant, then I would agree to bring to bear on that question the rest of Jesus' career, the way he bothered people, the way he set a movement in motion, the way he recruited people and told them to behave differently, so that in many ways he was resisting evil causes. And then the question is whether we want to claim that that is built into those particular Greek words. Some people, I say, actually, the Greek word means don't retaliate or don't respond in kind. Whether we want to base the argument on the level of Greek words or something wider. But for Tolstoy, it was actually the yielding, the no longer taking charge of history, the letting God do it, that was the necessary conversion experience. The other kind of discussion we'd have to carry that into the present is to ask what our resources are. If you're in a hopeless situation, then fighting back, even though it's noble, is useless. We think of fighting back in situations where it's not useless. Some of the early Christians, and Tolstoy's perspective sometimes, is situations where there'd be no point in fighting back, where it would just make things worse for you. But when I said at the outset that we're trying to understand a 19th century phenomenon for its own sake, one of its limits is that it comes up with a theory for passivity. And we'll move beyond that when we move tomorrow evening to another figure.
Perhaps part of her question could be answered by looking at Christ's life and his suffering, in that he doesn't resist the evil one. When it's time to be crucified and he's brought to trial, there's no speeches, there's no lawyers, there's no testimony. You know, he doesn't bring his disciples forth now and say, now is all of these things, are they true or not true? There's none of that. There's nothing from him but silence and his words, well, you've said so. And I think that supports a lot of what Tolstoy is saying, that when we're confronted with evil, you simply can't resist it. To break the cycle, one has to suffer, and that's what Christ does. To break that cycle, he simply does not resist his accusers, and unjustly he suffers.
Yeah, there'd be much about the Passion story that would go that way. There would be some things about the early ministry of Jesus where he's actually rabble-rousing, getting people in motion and criticizing the authorities and teaching the countercultural lifestyle, where he is offensive and aggressive. But the Passion story itself, he lets it be done to him. And from there on, I think that does fit. Although Tolstoy, as I said, is talking about the words of Jesus, he's less concerned about the rest of the gospel story or about Jesus as a model. And maybe because he thinks it's so obviously on his side that isn't what needs to be debated.
Can you say a little bit more about how Tolstoy, or even how the early Americans, North Americans, came to these positions? Was it strictly an intellectual, kind of rational, logical process that arrived to it, or can you identify experiences or parts of their lives, parts of their situations that would have led to this kind of an understanding?
Well, in Tolstoy's case, there was more, and he tells it biographically, so if you could ever find his confession in any other library than the Holden Library, you'll find his ups and downs and his just all of a sudden discovering that the church is a lot of baloney, and then that's because it's against Jesus, not because it's for Jesus. His career of losing faith in orthodoxy and finding faith in Jesus is very clearly biographically spelled out in relation to the disappointments of his social climbing, military, professional, bureaucratic culture. The American experience is different. I don't think we can do biography exactly for everybody, but there was a kind of national intellectual biography. That is, there was the surge of conviction of many people that the independence of this new nation was going to be a great thing. And then by 1815, we'd already had one stupid war that made no sense at all and wasn't for any known cause, and half the nation thought it wasn't just, even according to the rules of the just war. So people started seeing the whole military tradition brought over from Europe as a way to be national, as maybe like the other things in the old country that we should have left over there. And it's maybe not fitting the new world, just as all of these funny different national churches that we brought over here don't fit the new world. So it wasn't a deep personal biography, but it was a kind of a cultural biography, that the old world forms don't fit, we don't need them. Why don't we just strip down to essentials and just have the gospel? And then if ordinary, literate, generally educated, but not theologically traditional people just read the New Testament, they'll discover that the Gospels are more interesting than the Epistles, and that the moral teachings of the Gospels are quite transparent, easier to understand than the parables, easier to apply than the Passion story. So there's a kind of early cultural adolescence of the American frontier culture where it just makes good sense to take these texts straight. And it's the bright people that are doing it. That's the difference. And in our day, there are, it seems sometimes, the people who take the Bible straight are the obscurantists or the people from another part of the society that we don't think had colleges as good as ours. But then it was the people who were founding colleges that were reading the Bible this way. It was the cultural leaders. And they saw it as a way out of the complexity and confusion and the dullness and the cultural drudgery that all of that church history had brought to North America from the old country that we didn't really need. One more minute if somebody has a 1 minute question.
You said that Jan Hus was the first of the first reform of that time. But actually, his work was based on John Wycliffe.
Yeah, well, this didn't claim to be original. He was a renewer, and Wycliffe in England was one of the people he drew on. It was only the fact that he was martyred that made him a trigger to an upsurge of independence.
Yeah,
Wycliffe never created a church, the deep church split, but he had his followers who were persecuted. But the Czech movement became a national movement because of what happened to him. He wasn't the founder of the thing. Nor was he the founder of the nonviolent group. That was the next generation, Peter of Ketchup's. But it came out of the Hussite movement, and it was all there a century before Luther and Calvin came along with their revelation. Well, then tomorrow we'll talk about Gandhi, and we'll probably have more sources.